everybody. Welcome to the Why I Help podcast, the podcast that focuses on good people doing good things. The majority of the people out there are doing good things. The mainstream media likes to focus on murder and mayhem. We don't think that's a good way to go. So we're going to focus on people who are doing good things. And today we're going to talk to a gentleman named Michael Armstrong. Michael is an American business executive. He's former AT&T chairman and CEO. He's also former CEO of Hughes Electronics and Comcast Corporations. He worked for IBM from 1961 to 1992. He served as director of Citigroup from 1989 to 2010. Armstrong is a member of the Alfalfa Club. Not sure what that is. We'll get him to tell us. And the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also donated approximately $100 million to cancer research, among other causes. I'm not going to go into those other causes because I want him to share them with us. So without further ado, let's talk to Mike Armstrong. Mike Armstrong, thank you so much for being on the podcast today and telling us your story.
It's nice to be here, and I've heard a lot about you, so it's good to team up.
Awesome. I will say that with your business background, if I were looking for a CEO, I would probably try and hire you. I just want to say that.
Thank you.
Mike, where did you grow up? What was your childhood like? Oh. Just give us a little background.
I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, in the city itself. I went to a city high school that had over 5,000 students. And
wow.
So our schedules were more related to the way you get programmed in college. So some semesters I'd go to school 8 to 12, other semesters 10 to 3 or whatever, and I'd sign up for the curriculums. So it was a big city. It was a big city school. And then I played football in college and was really looking for a place where I could get a good education as well as play football. And I found Miami of Ohio. Now, I had 4 or 5 football scholarships lined up.
Four or five? Wow.
But I didn't. I just thought that Miami had the wonderful combination of being a beautiful school, high academic standing, and excellent of football. And that's what I was looking for.
Okay. Now, did you have any kind of dreams or goals, if you will, to be a professional football player? Was that ever in the cards for you? Or?
No. I knew I wanted to go on and earn a living. you'll learn more about my wife, I expect, in this interview. But we wanted to get married after college, and I didn't think playing football was the right way we would spend some of our life. So, no, I always intended to work for a living. I got injured pretty badly playing football. And there's just a little story over that. I got injured in my shoulder. It was a good straight-on tackle. And I hit a guy who was about 240. And he just dislodged my shoulder, so I had to get that operated on, and I went back to school, but they took my scholarship away.
Oh.
Same month that my dad's business went bankrupt.
Oh, no.
So I'm a college dropout.
Oh, okay.
I had to drop out of college, and I went to work on the docks on the night shift in Detroit for a year and earned enough to go back after 1 year.
Wow. Okay. But you ended up as the CEO and chairman of AT&T. How do you progress from there, from working on the dock so that you can make your tuition, going back to college? How did you get there?
Well, I'll try to be as net as I can, because I was going to graduate in 1961, and I had signed up to be in interviews with a number of companies coming on campus like they traditionally do, and boom, a bad recession hit. All, not some, all the companies canceled their interviews.
Wow.
So I thought, well, let's see. I'm in Oxford, Ohio, Southwest Florida. There's no businesses in the Oxford area. But I knew that down in Cincinnati, there was a great soap company, Procter & Gamble. I knew over in Indianapolis, where I had some friends, there was an IBM branch office. So I got my one suit out, dressed up, hitched rides, and got to Cincinnati and Indianapolis. And I interviewed those two companies and got two job offers. And I took the job offer from IBM. And that started my 31-year career with IBM.
Wow. So where did you start in IBM? What was your job?
Well, my first job was to be a salesperson and sell data processing equipment. Now, back then, this is going to make me just a little older than you probably think I am, but IBM didn't have computers when I joined them. They had punch card equipment. So I learned how to program punch card equipment. And since they didn't have any territories open, they made me what you call a systems engineer. And the salesman would sell it, and I would install it. And then they announced a stored programming computer. I thought, this is fascinating. And then I learned what all you had to learn and do to install a stored programming computer. And I volunteered for the marketing area. And I spent 9 years as a salesman for IBM. And then from there, I worked my way up. And 30 years later, retired as chairman of World Trade Corporation. All the countries reported to me outside of the United States.
Wow. Wow. Well, well done. That's what I call moving up the corporate ladder.
It was fun too.
I'm sure. Now, how did you then, go to AT&T? I'm just trying to get your background kind of.
Oh, sure. I went to IBM. I loved the company. We were moved 10 times all over the world with IBM.
Wow.
And that was fascinating. But after 31 years, and I had this wonderful job as chairman of World Trade, which I did for 4 years, I decided, you know, I think it's time to see something else. And so I retired from IBM. And concurrent with that, I was sought after by this company on the West Coast called Hughes Electronics. And the net of that is they offered me the job of CEO, and I moved to Los Angeles.
Okay. Wow. So let me ask you a question. I know that at some point in your corporate career, you were diagnosed with leukemia, correct?
That was my first cancer, leukemia. And you asked it at the perfect time. Because I went with Hughes, moved to a hotel looking for a home so Ann, my wife, could join me. I was already 2.5 weeks in this brand new job, and I get a call from my doctor on the East Coast who's completed my physical exam. He said, Mike, I'm sorry. You have leukemia.
Oh,
cancer. You've had it too long. I will call up the UCLA Cancer Center. I will get you an appointment. You need to go there first thing in the morning. Goodbye.
But, like, out of the blue?
Out of the blue.
Oh, my gosh.
The next morning, I got up, drove to the UCLA Cancer Center, met a fabulous doctor, and he put me on a clinical trial. I was the 100th person in a 100-person clinical trial.
Wow.
And so I was very fortunate to get this advanced I call it syrup. It was solution medicine.
Yeah.
And I took it 7x24 with a backpack full of it on my back. And of course, intravenous into my right arm because I'm left-handed. And then that basically killed all cancer in my body over 30 days.
Wow. And I was reading in your book, I won't tell you I read the whole thing, but I happened to just pick up a couple different chapters, and it said that, okay, so you've got this new job, and now you've been diagnosed with leukemia, and you have to do chemotherapy basically 24/7, and who do you tell? I mean, how do you tell?
No, you're very there was no way I could tell anyone but the board of directors of Hughes and their largest shareholder, General Motors. So I met with the board of Hughes. I told them what I had, what I was going to take, how long it would be before we knew whether we won or not, just 30 days. And they said, hang in there, but we can't tell anybody. I went to the General Motors board, had the same review, and they say 30 days, but we can't tell anybody. After 30 days, my blood counts were almost zero and all the cancer was gone.
Oh my goodness. Because you're saying you can't tell anybody because they're public companies and there goes the stock price. So the clinical trial worked then.
Yes.
Awesome.
It worked until midnight. And at midnight, I woke up the same day that was my last day on the medication with 103 degree temperature. Oh. And I knew I was in trouble. So I called a hospital and they said, you've got to come here immediately. Your cancer is unfolding and it's liquefying and it's in all of your body. You've got to come here. And I said, I really feel awful. I had 103 temperature. Can't you send an ambulance? And they said, Mike, haven't you watched TV? No, this was my first day without cancer. I didn't watch TV. I just had a nice dinner. And they said, we have the Rodney King riots going on all over Los Angeles. You have to drive through the riots to get to this hospital. Get in the car. So I got in the car, and that's a whole other chapter.
Oh,
driving through the Rodney King riots.
Oh, boy. I think we could probably spend a whole podcast on that one. But, Mike, before this happened, or how did you get into philanthropy? How did that all come about? I know I'm changing the subject, but I'm just kind of trying to get like the time track and kind of how that lays out.
Well, it's an excellent question because on the one hand, I had always tried to be generous and giving in my life. And that was, of course, always a factor of how much I made. And I go back to being in IBM where I was a marketing rep for 9 years and 25% of my money was on salary and 75% was on bonus compared to my performance. And so sometimes it was up and sometimes it was down. But when I got the cancer, it really changed my perspective on giving and giving back. And so I sat together and my wife and I talked it through and we concluded, let's give it all back, except what we've set aside for our three daughters. And so we changed our giving so that it escalated tremendously. And we give it back so much of our savings and our investments now. And I'm not going to give you a specific number, but just share with you that last year we gave back millions and millions of dollars.
Wow. Thank you for doing that. I mean, that's awesome that you're the exact kind of person we want to talk to on this podcast, because not everybody does that, do you know? And the fact that you and your wife came to that decision, I think, is huge. Kudos to her as well. I know she's not here on the podcast, but tell her that I said she's amazing. So what? Tell us about some of the charities that some of that money has gone to. What are some of the charities that are near and dear to you?
Well, I always did a lot of homework on the charities, because it's one thing to be this much money and you pretty much, you know, read about them and say, okay, I'll give them $100 or $400 or $300 here. That's how you give. And it usually takes an evening to do it. When you're going to give millions away, it's just natural to learn a tremendous amount about those who get the most in your giving. And that's why you brought it up earlier. One of the major donating team that I give to, and I go down there once and twice a year, is in Guatemala. The people in Guatemala, in the villages, are some of the poorest in the world. They literally have nothing but a straw hut, and they work on the farms and labor and get very low wages, sometimes about $5 or $6 a day. And they have on average 6 to 8 kids per family. And they're as nice and they're generous and they're as kind as you can imagine as a society. So friends of mine went down there and loved it so much to help the people that they became missionaries living full-time in Guatemala. And they put an organization together called People for Guatemala, and I'm the main giver. And we have just made villages and people and a med center and doctors part of their culture.
Wow, that's huge. I mean, that's changing lives down there. We had another gentleman on this podcast who talked about how he went to Mexico and stayed with some people, and all they had was a hut with a dirt floor, but they were so happy about what their life was like. And that's, you know, it sounds like the same thing with these villages in Guatemala. That's huge. That's awesome. A health clinic in Naples, Florida? Well, you did something for them?
Naples, I came across an organization that I've never encountered in my 17 moves all over the world. And that is an outfit who helped and developed and fed and financed the poor. And the poor was defined as everybody who made 2 times the average rate and down. So when I started in Naples with the neighborhood health clinic, there were over 50,000 people, families, who were in that category, who didn't really have enough income really to live on, let alone go to the doctor. And so I took on and joined the neighborhood health clinic, and now the treasurer of the neighborhood health clinic, and I'm one of their biggest givers, and that's what's reported in my treasurer's report.
And do you live down there? Do you live down near Naples, Mike?
I live in Naples 6 months, and I live in Darien, Connecticut 6 months.
Okay. Fair enough.
And so we call Naples home, and I would say that the neighborhood health clinic has grown from its 2 founders, and then me to four large medical buildings. And last year, they saw 15,000 patients.
That's amazing. That's awesome. I mean, we need more people like you, Mike. We need more people doing that kind of thing. That's why we're doing this podcast. So hopefully we can spur other people on to do that. Mike, tell us a little bit about your book. And thank you so much for sending it to us. But tell us a little bit about what prompted that and how that got going.
Yeah, because I had never intended to write a book. And when I got over my third cancer.
That's right. You said leukemia was the first. What were your other cancers, Mike?
Oh, yes. The first cancer was leukemia, hairy cell leukemia, that had metastasized badly. The second cancer was metastasizing prostate cancer, because for 2 years they had missed my PSA counts, which had gone down and down and down. And so when I got that cancer, I was a metastasizing cancer. And I also got something you may never have heard of concurrent with it, because my immune system really got mad at me for getting this cancer. And so it attacked my body. My immune system attacked me. And what it did was it took out the nerve systems going into my shoulder and down my chest, so that my lungs were attacked. And I ended up fighting my second cancer with only 18% lung capacity. And you know, that's a tough combination.
Yeah.
And there's back then, when I asked the doctor, because it's called brachial plexus neuritis, and he said, there's only 17 other Americans who have this, so there's no medications. You just hope that you get better. One third of people never get better. Some of them get better just like you are about now, and then some of them, it goes away. And we have no idea what's going to happen to you. That was the background to your question. When I got through my third cancer, which was a cancer of the cells called carcinoma, and I had five carcinoma surgeries. No, I'm sorry, I had seven, because I have five carcinomas, cancer problems. But when I got done with that, I said, you know, being a cancer patient three times has taught me something I should not let pass. And that is that there's no cure for cancer. So when people get it, they don't know whether they're going to live a couple of months, a couple of years, or longer. And so they need something to do the best within that envelope, because no one's going to save their life, per se. And so I invested a lot of money in cancer. You can get into that, but my purpose was so that people saw the rest of their life, and it was as a living person, not someone who was going to just be dead. And I've now lived 30 years with the three cancers.
Wow.
So it's not predetermined. And one of them, they said, you've got a 50-50 chance to live 5 years. So it's your determination. It's your will. It's your passion. It makes a difference that you just never give up.
Yep. That's huge, Mike. Huge. Yeah.
And that nobody's happier to get up in the morning.
Exactly. I recently had my 70th birthday, and I said, yeah, you know, it just doesn't seem realistic. And my friend said, well, you know what my dad always said, look at the alternative.
That's right.
So you wrote the book, and the book I'm imagining is to inspire others to have that outlook.
Well, that's what I titled it, To Encourage. back a number of years when I decided to do the book, I had to think of a title, and I was so, I guess, thrilled that Cancer with Hope had not been protected. And I protected it. It said in three words everything I was trying to say in 170 pages. That when it's all said and done, never give up hope. Always come back and fight. Always try to overcome what looks like something that will never get fixed, because it can get fixed. You can overcome it. And so approach it with love.
Wow. I was going to ask you, that's such a great message for everybody listening. I was going to ask you if you could tell the story that you wrote about in the book about your dad. Now I will tell you, I tried to read it to my husband and couldn't get through it. So maybe you can get through it.
So which one?
The music, his friend, the saxophonist.
Which one?
Was that your dad that was in hospice and with leukemia? And his friend with a saxophone came in?
Yep. Okay. My dad retired in Naples. And of course, that's where we retired, in Naples. And my dad played the drums in a jazz band. Now, he did that when he was in college. And he had a very nice career. But when he retired, he got drums and took it up again and joined a band. And so here he is, 80, 81, 82, 83, 84 years old. And every weekend, he's out there playing drums in a jazz band. So when he's a little over 91, he calls me and say, "Mike, you got to come over." And I knew this was coming. I've got to go live in hospice now. And he had advanced cancer. And so I came over and we packed his bags and I took him out of the car. And then he says, "Mike, no. Go back in," it was a condo, "go back in a condo. I want the snare drum. I want the cymbals. I want the sticks and I want the brushes. Bring them in the car." What in the world is he going to do in hospice? So I take him with us, right? And I get him out of the back seat, or I'm sorry, the trunk, and I take him up to his room, and I set him in a corner. I set him all up, but I set him in a corner. Well, 5 days later, he's laying in bed, of course, and the phone rings, and I answer it, and he said, "Hi, this is Don. I'm the saxophone player in the band with your dad, and I'd like to come over and see him." So I put the cell phone over here. I said, "Hey, Dad, it's Don. He wants to come over and see you." My dad sits up in bed. Big smile comes, and he says, "Don, he can only come over if he brings his saxophone." So Don comes over. My dad pushes his drums and cymbals out into the hallway. Don's got a thing for his saxophone that he can just put on his chest. They go out there. They play a couple familiar tunes, and they take requests from hospice patients who are going to die in 4 or 5 days, nurses, doctors, staff, and visitors. And they do that for over an hour.
Wow.
He comes back in the room, puts those drums in the corner, gets in bed, and never wakes up again.
Wow. That is such a beautiful story. And I will tell you that I can see where you get part of your positive outlook and your hope from a man like that. I mean, that is just such a wonderful story, Mike.
Thank you. I was just so proud of him.
I can imagine. So tell us the name of your book again and how people can
Cancer
get your
with
book.
Hope.
Okay. And it's on Amazon, I assume.
Yes, it's on Amazon. That's as far as I know. Let me explain one thing. It's only about 155 pages of reading. I had a third cancer that I was ready to write, which would have taken another 25 or 40 pages. And I sat back and thought through my three cancers. And during those cancers, when I got all this stuff being poured in me or aimed at me, I found it kind of tough to read a lot of pages. And so I thought, Cancer with Hope, my first audience are cancer patients. To give them the will and the determination, the outlook, and the end of the book, that I'm still alive. And they'll only read 4 or 5 pages a night, because that's all I could read. And that's why it's 150 pages.
It's awesome. I picked it up. I just read little bits of it. And I'll tell you, everything I read was very engaging. I think that I'm just thankful for you and your wife and everything you do and the book that you wrote. It's inspiring. I hope that the people listening get inspired, because I definitely got inspired. I can't thank you enough for talking to us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I thank you very much. I appreciate your interest and your questions, and I hope to meet you again.
Oh my goodness. What a wonderful man. There are so many people out there doing good things. If you're doing good things, and maybe you weren't the CEO of AT&T, doesn't matter. If you're doing good things to help people, reach out to us, because we'd love to tell your story. We want more and more stories like that. Y'all have a good week. We'll be back with another interview. Good news, good people, doing good things.